The WLEW News and Public Affairs Department now presents What Do You Think? Here is your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. I have a couple of guests in the studio today. We have Captain Ron Burkhardt. He's the author of a book that's coming out on the Point of Barks Lighthouse. Also have fellow author Janice Stein. She's helped Ron in his book endeavors, and she's also associated with the Lakeshore Guardian. She did a program with us a while back on the single room schoolhouse books that you were writing. So thanks for returning.
You're welcome. Happy to be here today.
Ron, first of all, it's a book on the Point of Barks Lighthouse. How did this come to be? What gave you the initial thought to do it? Because I know a lot of people, there's a book in me somewhere, but they don't know where to start. Well, what was there, some just one thing that happened or a series of events?
There were a couple of things. And thanks for having me on. I really appreciate this. We founded the Point of Barks Lighthouse Society in 2002. And while we were doing that, we wanted to put up displays in a museum and find accurate information. And right away we saw that there was a lot of inaccurate information out there, a lot of conflicting facts. So that was the start of probably finding the data and the research.
So you had to take the folklore out of it and try and find what you could verify that you could really say this happened. This is a story that was told of it. It may or may not be quite the way it's been handed down.
That's right, and you also needed a lot of the folklore because families kept their history, and that may have been the only source for a lot of these facts on the Lighthouse. So you had to kind of balance it out. You had to check what they were telling you, and a lot of them had believed facts for a long time that then you had to disprove.
So you spoiled their illusions on occasion.
You had to be very, very polite, but I really appreciated their information, and they had a lot of pictures, these people, different relatives of the keepers. So they were a great help. I don't want to say that they were always inaccurate, because they weren't. But it just sometimes you had to thread a fine line, walk a fine line between folklore and fact.
It must get harder the further back you go, though, to get like pictures and such, because long ago that was a main big deal to get a picture taken. It isn't like today where you just take a snapshot of the lighthouse. It would have been something kind of formal, maybe a wedding picture or a changing of the guard kind of picture, rather than just day-to-day stuff.
Well, that's true, and probably I'm trying to think the oldest picture that we have of the lighthouse from probably 1896. We had a relative send in a picture, which would have been a daguerreotype from 1847, which I'm not sure the accuracy of that, but it was a nice picture of the first keeper at the lighthouse. It would have been a very rare artifact if it was accurate.
And do you kind of have to judge it by, there's the lighthouse in the background, you know the lighthouse? I mean, you can have a picture of somebody standing in front of some trees, and then basically it could be anybody. You have to research this all back to put a real name and face to the picture you got.
And that's happened too, where I've seen official like the Coast Guard websites have the wrong picture up for Point of Barks Lighthouse. So you do have to look at what's there, look at the surroundings. But the one on the Captain Shook was interesting because folklore said he rowed a boat to get a doctor for his wife. Well, he had one arm and fingers missing off the other hand in his picture. So right away it cast doubt on, is this the guy?
Yeah, it would have been difficult. It would have been a heroic story if it's accurate.
It was a good family story, but we know now with the help of Bob McGreevy, he by chance found an article in Escoda doing research for something else that Captain Shook actually died on a doctor's boat that was going to get supplies in Detroit. Dr. Heath had a boat in New River by Huron City. Back then there were no lighthouse tenders, so they had to contract a boat. And Shook was actually on a boat. It was just a doctor's boat. It disappeared with all hands. So he did die, but not rowing a boat to get a doctor.
And that's what lighthouses are all about, is to keep ships from going down, not knowing where they're at and such. They were a safety measure in a time of low tech, but then they used high tech because they had these Fresnel lenses and such that just shone the light out so far, and a little lamp with I don't know, some kind of oil running it would send a light out so many miles. It was very ingenious for its time.
Very high tech for what they had, but lighthouses were designed for really two reasons. Safety, to tell where you had a safe harbor, and warn of danger. So
because there's a reef.
There's a reef there or something. So you and that's why they have the different flashes of light so they know where they're at.
Because you could be coming up and see a lighthouse. You need to know which one you're looking at on your chart because the danger is in a different spot each time you go by a lighthouse.
Yes, and they made mistakes. They would switch out lenses and everybody wouldn't get the word. They switched the lens out at the lighthouse, Point of Barks Lighthouse, from a fixed to a flash, and 1873 they fixed it back to a flash, put it back to a flash. So they changed, there were four lenses there, but the first 10 years it was all candle, lantern, and reflector. There was no lens.
It seems hard to believe that a candle is what you're using to shine a lighthouse. I realize if you have the proper lensing in front of it, you might be able to focus a lot of light in a single direction, but you were talking, there's just a reflector. That'd have to be a lot more than one of them little Yankee candles we have today.
I may have misspoke when I said candle. They used a Candarella.
Candarella.
Which was a lantern. Some of them were, most of them were round wick, one, two, or three wicks in them. And these lanterns inside these lenses were 5 foot tall. The chimney was probably 3 foot tall. And they used to smoke the chimney, not have the wick trimmed correctly. And that was a bad deal. They would get reported if that light wasn't rotating correctly or if the light wasn't bright enough. They would be reported by the ship's captain out on the lake, might not be able to see it or timed right, or the life-saving station or anybody could turn them in. It must have been a nightmare for these guys.
Well, when you're using oil and such as fuel, there's soot. And, you know, it's not like energy, clean electricity. I mean, in those lenses or anything you have there, they're a magnet for that kind of stuff. they will collect it and make it, and then you couldn't run down and buy some Windex to clean it off. You had to have your own little formula of what works to make it clean. That was we think they're just sitting around there watching the light go around. There was a whole lot of work to this.
No, I would say that it was very touchy. That equipment was very touchy for its day. Even a fingerprint on one of those lenses, when they heated up to almost over 200 degrees, the glass would heat up. The oil on your fingerprint could damage the lens.
And they were kind of like the halogen lights that you have in your car.
If you touch them wrong
when you install them, when they heat up, they pop.
And we didn't, maybe they didn't even realize that because there's damage on the lens like that. But there was a lot of rules. These people worked under a lot of rules. They had unannounced inspections, the lighthouse keepers, and they were living there with their wife and family. Everybody had to be on their toes because you never knew when you're going to inspect it. Twice a year, they just sail up, row in, and I can imagine it was hard on the keeper. And they work 16-hour days at least. But the wives
work all night too. I mean,
they
don't go to bed knowing the lamp's burning and say, "I'm sure it'll be on till morning."
They usually split the shifts if they had a keeper, but they had all the maintenance to do during the day, and the wives had to keep the house spotless. Beds made, everything perfect, almost like a white glove inspection, and if you didn't do well, you could be fired. And there were no pensions, there were no arbitration, you're done.
Was it a lonely life for the family out there, or is that kind of a misconception? Because, you know, if you were on like the Reef Lighthouse at Port Austin, you're off from shore and there may be times you can't get in there, but, you know, if you're on shore like Point Au Barques at what is now Lighthouse County Park, you'd could have access to people around you, farming and lumber people. I mean, there might have been people around that wouldn't make it quite that isolated.
I believe that too. Maybe at first it was really isolated, but probably by the 1860s, once Huron City was established, a New River as lumbering camps in Port Hope, they probably had a lot more. The life-saving station came there in 1876.
Then you had other people there.
So you had other families, a lot more people. Lifesavers didn't necessarily have their families in the station, but they built cottages on the property. So it was probably tough at first, 1847, first 10 years, 15 years. They didn't have a system keeper till 1849. So that those first keepers had to do all that work by themselves.
I bet
all
they
night
relied
long.
On the missus quite a bit.
And they did. They had records that if something broke on the lens, like the winding mechanism, and these people had big families, 8, 9 kids living at the lighthouse, and they would take turns cranking that lens all night by hand. And it had to crank at the right revolution, like 2 minutes, flash every 2 minutes.
Now, did it turn basically like
grandfather
clock? You had a set of weights, you put it up there, and they would go down, and it would turn the light at a prescribed speed with clutches or whatever to make sure that it's spinning properly. And if you got the weight to the bottom, you had to hand crank it till somebody got the weight back up, and away you went? Or would it last all night, maybe?
No, it never lasted all night. And very interesting, because I found some of the weights in the tower pocket when I pried it open. They'd been there 70 years. And then I started to read the logs more to find out. They would probably last about 2 hours on a good crank up, but it depended on, they used lard to do the chariot wheel lubrication that the lens spun on. They would vary in weight from 50 pounds to maybe 180 pounds hanging on that weight cable.
Lard sounds like it would get kind of rank up there with the heat and the daylight and the sun.
Sure.
It sounds like it would odiferous.
Yes. And the timing of it, I wouldn't have wanted to have been up there working. It's glorified today. It was a tough, hard job. But the more weight you put on, the more things were apt to break. Mm-hmm. But you also had to get the timing right. So they were constantly doing things with the weights, cleaning the chariot wheels, lubricating anything they could, because they could lose their job if it wasn't timed right.
Wow. Now, you were mentioning, we talked a little bit before the show, Point of Arcs Lighthouse was built in the wrong place.
That's my opinion.
it wasn't the intended spot anyway.
Yes. I believe that, and in the book I present facts and let the reader decide. I think I build a pretty good case. Janice has read it maybe 10 times and probably has an opinion for him. But in 1847, this was a remote area. When they sent that surveyor up here from the government in probably 1845 or 1846, he picked a point that had a rocky bluff at the tip of the thumb in the present-day Point of Arcs Resort, which wasn't founded until the late 1800s, 1895 or 6, the resort. The Point of Arcs name was known for a long time, back in the 1700s. So they had the name. So this guy came up, surveyed a 2-acre spot. Somehow when the builder came up, he stopped at a similar location 9 miles away in Lighthouse County Park, Rocky Bluff, Reef Offshore, and built that building, the tower and the keeper's dwelling, 65-foot tower, in probably 4 months. Did a good job.
Well, I imagine they'd have to get it done in a season. It isn't something you want to leave open
right
through a winter and come back to. You'll never know what you're coming back to.
And I can't find documentation. It was done by October 1st of 1847. They discussed whether they should hire a temporary keeper, but I cannot find that they actually did and lit the light in 1847. But I have pay records of March 31st of 1848, where they actually hired Peter Shook and started to pay him. So we say the light was lit in 1848. It was built in 1847.
But basically, this was just a spot on the shore. There were no roads to it. The only way to get stuff there was by boat to ship it in, and the only way to get a keeper in and out was to have a ship stop and pick them up.
Which there may have been Indian trails there. It seems
nothing you're going to carry any household
no map
furniture or anything around.
It's hard to believe, and I've had people discuss this with me and say, no, they couldn't have made that bad a mistake back in 1847. But I believe they could have.
Where was their GPS? Come on.
I believe
global
they could
have. Global positioning, come on.
I think we have a pretty good case on that point.
But eventually then they created the Port Austin Reef Lighthouse at the very tip to help ships make it around the very tip of the thumb.
Yes, in 1878.
It might have been fortuitous. It gave them, you know, a warning of the reef in front of that place as well.
I'm sure
that's what they... didn't turn too sharp to get into there and then all of a sudden found you're in a place you don't want to be.
Correct, and Port Austin Reef is definitely a much more dangerous reef than the one off Lighthouse County Park. So I'm sure they wanted that reef marked. And it just took them so long to correct that error to 1878. The records in Washington always refer to the Point of Arcs Lighthouse in Lighthouse County Park as a turning point into Saginaw Bay, which is not correct. They also wanted to be able to see lighthouses in a row. If you were leaving one, say Charity Island, you could see the next one. That didn't happen until later on.
Like breadcrumbs, you know, you follow the next lighthouse and you can see it. And not only does it tell you there's a problem there, but it actually gives you a target to cross the bay.
Yes.
Well, that was ingenious. I mean, they were really thinking of these things, and you know, as to how to make shipping try to be safer. I know we've had a lot of wrecks, but that's Mother Nature more than I think people not paying attention to the lighthouses.
And I think today too, people don't realize that it was tougher back then. If you leave shore off here, I'm sure the boaters know that.
Talk to the sheriff about kayaks.
It's hard to see where you're at when you look back, and. Back then, they always sailed these ships pretty well in sight of shore. They wanted to be close to shore so they could pick out where they were at. Otherwise, they were sailing by dead reckoning. And you're right, there's a lot of shipwrecks out there. A lot of them within sight of that lighthouse. We dived the wrecks. Most of the time you're on the boat, you can see that lighthouse from these wrecks. It's just a shame that there was so much tragedy out there. And the lighthouse didn't necessarily play a part in that. If there was a bad storm, they wouldn't have been able to see the light.
Were the lighthouses designed not only for the light to be visible, but their structure during the day? Did they paint them like white so they really stood out? I know some of them have like spirals on them and such to differentiate, you know, the next one down. Is there a little visual aspect during the day as well as the night light?
Yes, there is. Notice the mariners that most of the captains had on the ships told the flash of the light, the characteristic of the light, the timing, the color. But the towers were listed for height, color. The tower could be striped, like you said. Point of Arcs was yellow originally, light yellow, because it had a Milwaukee cream brick. It wasn't whitewashed and painted white till sometime that I can't find
it. But it was made to stand out against the green background.
Yes.
of the trees behind it, so that during the day when you were out sailing, you could differentiate this one from any other lighthouse in your area.
Correct, and that's a good point on that. I kind of didn't think that through all the time, because the light ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, from probably 1969 when they put the DCB-224 aero beacons in there and took the lens out. So when I was up there working and living there, that light never shut off day or night. If you were out on the lake during the daytime, you could still see the flash. But now it's back to a flashing beacon. I'm sure it only flashes at night. So, good point. That's
now, the original lighthouse that was built when they kind of had the oopsie, that didn't last very long. A lot of times the original lighthouses didn't work out in Harbor Beach either. They basically didn't hold up to the elements, especially when you're in a very extreme environment with only ships to be able to bring in repair supplies. So it only lasted how long?
10 years the first one lasted. It's kind of funny, it's kind of ironic. When these lighthouses were built, they were the best buildings in the county, especially by 1857. That was probably, other than the courthouse and barracks here, that was probably the most, the best well-built and fancy building. And yet the first one failed in 10 years because they use inferior materials. We don't have a picture of it. We have the building plans and the contract.
So you could visualize it from the plans a little bit, but you don't have the image of it.
We actually had the Tech Center students here through Gary Mills take that contract. They did two things. They built a nice, I gave them two sets of prints. I gave them the building contract from 1847 and the 1857 blueprints. They built a replica of the present lighthouse, but they also used the building contract from 1847 to use CAD-CAM or something to give four different aspects, visuals of what it looked like.
So that we kind of computer-aided design programs that they have that basically put it on a screen. You can spin it around,
excellent,
walk through it, and see what it would have been like.
Excellent. The only view that we would have. Now, I chased on lots of leads that people said they had. Family lore said they had picture of the lighthouse gentleman from Florida, from the 1847 lighthouse, which I went down and interviewed him there on Merritt Island. Nice gentleman, but the picture turned out, and I traced it down through the Port Austin Library. It was not an 1847 Point of Arcs lighthouse. It was a picture taken off a lighthouse greeting card and somehow grafted onto something and got the recognition that this was it, and it was not.
And this is how history can be, you know, stumbling. When people with all good intents at the time, you know, send you a nice lighthouse pictured card, it isn't really the authentic, and then it gets saved, and historians try to look at it and reconcile the plans said it should look like this, and this doesn't look like it.
I still love the people, though. If it wasn't for them coming forward, there'd be a lot of stuff unknown.
Is it hard to find period or even original pieces from what may have been used inside by a lighthouse keeper? A lot of this is very old. They weren't designed to last forever to begin with, but it is kind of makes it nicer when people go through the lighthouse to have period pieces and things that would at least represent what it would have looked like in its day.
We have a lot of paper documentation, but actual artifacts, they're very valuable. The Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard in Washington, did lend us some items. But generally, when the Lighthouse Service merged in with the Coast Guard, when the Lighthouse Service merged with the Coast Guard in 1939, in 1915, it wasn't it the Revenue Cutter became the Coast Guard with the life saving? They merged in 15. So it took a while for the lighthouses to merge into that same service, and they wanted to destroy all those older artifacts that had all the lighthouse service, LHS, LHE establishment.
Not realizing that down the road these would be important, but these would be valuable.
They did the same thing when the life-saving service merged into with the Revenue Cutter into the Coast Guard. They wanted the Coast Guard to be it. It was a new thing, and get rid of all this old stuff. There's records where they box it up and shipped it, but sometimes they just destroyed it. It's very valuable today. There are collectors out there.
Is most of it from old keepers who took a souvenir or something? Is there a lot out there that way? Because, you know, there had to be accurate timepieces in these things, and you know, because you had to keep an accurate record of what happened at what time, especially if there might be a wreck outside.
I can't say too much because some of the families do have some things. We've chased down some. Some of them have been gracious enough to loan them, put them on loan, or donate them to the Lighthouse Museum. It's exciting. I know there's stuff out there yet. We just haven't been able to get it all. I'd like to especially get all the log books back to the lighthouse. There was a fire there in the late 50s. In 1871, the fire almost burned that lighthouse down. I've got a record of recommendation from Washington that for Keeper Shaw.
Now, when you say the fire, are we talking the big fire?
As big as 81, but the 71 fire was devastating in that area. And it almost burned it down, and they recognized that he was instrumental because he was there alone. Life-saving station wasn't there. In 1881, he had help because he had the lifesavers next door to help him. And again, it almost burned down. But then in the 1950s, they had a caretaker who liked to stopped at the local tavern in Port Hope, and he was a smoker, and he smoked in bed.
Oh, dear.
And he caught it on the main dwelling on fire. And when I was working in there painting one day, I noticed the floorboards were different, and the wall boards were drywall in spots, not just plaster and lath. So I went down the basement and looked up, and there were gaping burn holes in the floor.
Oh, dear.
So I started to investigate, and when that fire occurred, I found a witness that said they were taking log books and just throwing them out the window to save them, and they got picked up by the general public, and some of them have made their way back and some of them haven't. I'd just like to see what's in them. People can keep them. We just like the record of it.
You can scan them in and they'll be a permanent computer record.
That's all we want. We just want the information.
Now, I understand the light saving station's coming back. The road commission was at the county commissioner's meeting about 2 weeks ago or so. They're going to be moving it from Huron City, where it was moved in the 60s to try and preserve it, back to near its original location near the lighthouse.
That will be interesting. That's a great thing. Long time. It was the same people that had the lens, and it took our last Fresnel lens. It took a long time to get the lens back. This, I think, is going a little quicker, although it's been years in the process. And Bill Bonner is spearheading that. He with the park trustees, without those people's involvement, volunteers, it wouldn't happen. But it will come back, and it'll be probably one of the only places. We go to different places in the state, life-saving stations and lighthouses. This one here, by the time that station's back there, is going to be one of the best ones in the state, and it's free.
Well, and Neil Henschel from the Road Commission was telling the commissioners a lot of these didn't survive. There are very few original life-saving station buildings available. We've got the building and the one that was built next to it. He was saying it was something like the commander didn't want to live with the troops, so he built a place next to it, and there was a little breezeway between the two.
It is. That was the first station to open on the Great Lakes on September 15th, 1876. Now, there was another one listed opening the same day. I think that's kind of a gray area, but that one doesn't exist up at Sturgeon Point. So this one came back. We had Keep Lifesavers Die There. That's going to be another interesting book. And
they had to row out there. They didn't have, you know, the little inflatable, you know, rescue boats the Coast Guard has today and stuff to zip on out there with, 50-horse motor on the back or whatever. They had to hand row out through these major storms to try and help the ship, people from the ship that had struck a reef or were going down. It was a very harrowing lifestyle,
tough
I would think.
Life. And we talked a little before the show, and I could get in trouble for saying that, but lighthouse keepers are really popular today in lighthouses. They're at the top of the heap, you know. Lighthouses sell calendars and newspapers, and those lifesavers work for $40 a month, didn't get the recognition. Their buildings are all torn down. Most of their history is gone, and we want to bring that back. And the nice thing about the station in here in the city is it has a lot of artifacts in it. It has the man-beam mortar, the Lyle guns, the signal boards, life-saving cars. It has a lot of stuff from that period. I interviewed the woman that owns the Grindstone City Station, which was moved into the Point of Arcs Resort, and moved it over the ice or moved it on the sand. I can't find the documentation. It was moved in the late 1890s. It was built in 1881.
Well, they moved them because they were well-constructed buildings at the time. It wasn't like, you know, you're moving a shack. These were premier buildings.
And they were built in an incredibly short time because they had no electricity, no insulation, no drywall. They could build them in 4 or 5 weeks with a crew. They were movable, like you say, but I'd like to know how they moved that one from Grindstone, which was near Burnt Cabin Point, only about a mile down to the resort area down there. It's on the beach. You can only see it from the water. It's on private property.
Well, she I understand has, the move from Huron City is only like 1.2 miles.
That's hill.
But it's
steep hill.
But nowadays, you have to worry about the overhead wires and everything else. It's not quite as simple a move.
Yeah. That building that is going to be moved is more of an H-shaped or U-shaped building, where the one that was moved to the Grindstone Station was just a single building, story and a half, much simpler back in the day. Mm-hmm. This would be interesting to see if that building gets away from them on those hills.
Well, it's a road commission. I'm sure they have big trucks. So they built the second one. That one is the one that's still there. That one endured.
Mm-hmm.
So they learned a lesson from that first one on building practices and how things hold up with the weather around the Great Lakes.
An incredible job because they did use some of the old brick, stone, but they used more brick. But the tower was taller, too. Those lighthouses are constructed as like the inside is a cylinder. When you see the taper on them, the outside wall is what's tapered. There's a 1 foot gap between the straight up cylinder, usually 8 foot diameter, maybe 12 inch thick brick wall.
So they're thicker at the bottom.
Thicker at the bottom on the outside.
To disperse the weight of all that mass
as it
comes down.
Excellent job. I go to the ones on the East Coast in the Florida area. They're 200 feet tall and they withstood hurricanes and still are standing.
We've got some big gales up here too that aren't that may not be Hurricane Irma or anything, but they I'm sure put it to the test and the test of the people who had to ride them out.
Storm of 1913 would have took this one down if any storm did. So that it withstood that.
Now, where is the lens right now? Is that at the site of the lighthouse? Is it in the lobby area of the lighthouse, or where is it?
It's in the old office area on the first floor of the dwelling. What I'd like to see done is this lens set on a riser that was 5 foot tall. So I like to tell people the whole thing set on a pedestal, which is still up in the tower, and I think that pedestal is from 1857. They use that pedestal, even though they changed lenses, they kept that original pedestal. I'd like to see the pedestal brought down and put on display. We don't have the riser anymore, but when you put all that together, the pedestal, the riser, and the lens, it was 14 foot tall from the floor up to the bearings and the fume hood in the tower. It was a massive, heavy affair.
And this is crystal. This isn't light stuff. You know, we can make things out of plastic today that are light. In fact, Harbor Beach had a replica built that they put in their lighthouse of the original lens. So there's one in there that looks like it, but it's not crystal. It's you know, plexiglass, and it's kind of neat to see. But the original one is in the Grice Museum. You have the original one in the old office area, and it might be something down the road you may think of, like they did to try and, so when people go up there, they see it as it was.
That'd be interesting. And this is the original last Fresnel lens that was in there.
There was another one in there for
I believe that there were four lenses in there.
Oh.
Two for sure after 1857 on, they used lenses. The first 10 years, they used 9 hanging lanterns with reflectors, parabolic reflectors and a chandelier arrangement. Once they went to converting Great Lakes lighthouses to lenses, we had the only 16-panel bullseye lens made by Henry Lepoutre, Paris, France, for $10,000. That's an 18.
And that's $10,000
in 1873.
That's a lot of money back then.
We had switched lenses with the railroad. By the railroad station in Port Huron, the Fort Gratiot light. We had a fixed light, a flashing light, and a temporary light there. So I've got it pretty well all recorded.
So you basically, when you change the pattern of the light, need a different lens to make that pattern. There has to be blackout spots in it where if it's flashing as it goes around, it's dark and light at other times. So it takes almost, you can't retrofit these things. They're just too expensive and too complicated. It's better to replace it and sell the lens or send it to a different lighthouse that could use one like that.
They did, and the problem with that was if you switch lenses too close like they did with Port Huron, they had too much confusion. They had near riots and ship captains. I've seen petitions with 30 ship captains signing it where they were wrecking their ships because they didn't apparently get the word that this light had gone from flashing to fixed. And it was very interesting, but we were back to a flashing lens. Once every 10 seconds that lens flashed in 1873, and that's what was in there till 1969. It was electrified in 1932. They put a light bulb inside that lens. It took them 2 years to figure out if they had electricity. They could turn the lens with a motor with electricity, and in 1934 they put electric motor on there.
Now, was there a foghorn there? Or I know Harbor Beach is rebuilding their foghorn building. Did Lighthouse, Point of Barks Lighthouse have
that's
a foghorn?
Because,
you know, it would seem to me when there's fog out there and you can't see, you still got to let people know, hey, we're here.
Oh, I'm familiar with Harbor Beaches. I'm sure Janice is too. That thing blew all the time, even when it wasn't foggy. But we had
sounds like a little bit of a in that, but okay.
We had records that this was equipped with a fog signal, and
that would be something
not.
You'd have to keep steamed up.
Oh yes,
for when you needed it. I mean,
there were different types of mechanisms, but most of them needed that big building with a steam boiler. I was almost convinced there was a fog bell there because there is one setting at Huron City. But that fog bell came from Mystic Seaport, Connecticut. I tracked that down. They never had one at Point of Barks. There are two Point of Barkses in Michigan. That's where the confusion came in.
Oh, okay.
There's a Point of Barks up at Lake's tip of Lake Michigan, in past Escanaba. If I Manistique, past that area, there's a small area at Point of Barks. And when they kept writing, they never did build one there, but they wanted a fog signal there. So when you deal with Washington in those days, there was a lot of confusion on that. So no, there was never a fog signal. There's a column in the keeper's log, in the watch log, to list what was going on with the fog signal, and they never put anything in it.
Oh, okay.
So that's pretty good proof.
Well, they kept records, and that's the one thing they're good at.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Lighthouse Society that you have for the Point of Arcs Lighthouse, is this something that you are actively seeking more help with? Is this something that people can contact you folks in the association and say, hey, I'd like to get involved?
We have a website, and Bill Bonner is president now, probably around 100 members, I believe. It takes volunteers, and these people work hard and volunteer a lot of hours and money, but you're working for a worthwhile cause. You're there at the lighthouse. You would actually spend time right there doing things you like. And
there are a lot of things you can do that, even if you don't have the skills to do the restoration work, when they're working, you can help by, you know, running a barbecue and getting people fed when the afternoon shift comes in. You know, these types of things, you know, you wonder, oh, what could I do there? You'll find things
There's
they can
always,
do.
Always, always, skill, your skill will be put to use. We have the festival, first Saturday in August each year. We started that in 2004, which was a nice thing because it got the county to recognize where this lighthouse was at. And we used to have a two-day affair with a dinner on Saturday night, but we're all getting older. You know, we're getting up in our 70s and 80s.
Yeah, we're cutting back. Where we need restoration.
We're cutting back on the hours and the dinner. But yes, the society is going. It's done an incredible amount of work with the county road commissioners. You can't have just the society working without the trustees, the park trustees, who are the road commissioners, because they own the lighthouse. And they support it. If they didn't support it, these things wouldn't happen. The new roof, air conditioning, heat, windows, doors, all those things are in a cooperation with the county, and I'm really happy.
And a cooperation to try and keep things close to authentic, or
yes,
at least look authentic, because obviously, you know, air conditioning was not a thing back then, but
you won't see that.
But you need to keep people comfortable, and it helps to keep the artifacts you have inside from deteriorating,
yes,
any quicker. It has benefits that outweigh the lack of originality.
It does, and that's a good point, because we used to have to clean it out, all the artifacts, put them in the heated storage for the winter, and It just keeps humidity out of the lighthouse, the air conditioning. The heat stops a lot of the plaster cracking that was occurring. It's sealed up pretty good. A squirrel got in one year, chewed up the inside of the window frames. Poor guy never got out. But it's a lot different than it was 15 years ago. It's just incredible.
Time is going really quick here. I wanted to note that there was a couple of firsts at the lighthouse. You had the first woman lighthouse keeper.
Had the first woman lighthouse keeper. That was documented.
Before women's lib and,
yes,
the suffragettes and all of that, she was manning a lighthouse.
Other women have helped their keeper husbands, but when her husband died, she had to be appointed. We have the documentation, and she was the first woman lighthouse keeper in Michigan. Her husband was the first lighthouse keeper to die while on duty in Michigan.
Not a good first.
No, this, and a lot of that was not known, but we did an archaeological dig there in 2003 and found the original site for the 1847 lighthouse. So there's a lot of things interesting going on. Always when you go out there and work and go to the meetings, there's something interesting going on.
Okay, before we have to wrap things up, give the people the name of your book, where they can find it if they want to get a copy. It's a nice, large, hard-bound copy book, perfect for a coffee table, and there's lots of pictures inside that show the history. How do people get the book?
They can. The book's on sale at some of the local stores in the area. It's on sale at the Lighthouse Gift Shop. The book is called A Comprehensive History. What is it? A Comprehensive History Written by a Native Son. I did the Native Son just to say that I grew up by the lighthouse and didn't know a lot about it. That's why I put Native Son on there. You can order it. but you'd probably have to have a book to mail to order it.
Well, you can go on Facebook for Nautical Images and follow Ron there. And Ron is going to have a book signing at Ace Hardware this Saturday in Bad Axe at Ace Hardware from...
You can see Ron right there. 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. Saturday in Bad Axe, Ace Hardware.
Correct. And also this weekend is Huron County Museum weekend. So stop by, meet Ron, pick up his book, and then take a trek out to the Point of Barks Lighthouse, climb the tower, and walk the grounds.
And if you have stories about the lighthouse, he'd love to hear them. And even if he can kind of grimace and say, some of that isn't quite right, he likes to hear it because sometimes you pick little gems out of there that lead you to other places that can help you find other facts that would have otherwise gone the way of the dodo. We would never know about them.
Yes, if
you have any record books that you would like to contact Ron about, his phone number is 231-935-4217, or if you'd like to schedule an interview with Ron or find out some more information about the lighthouse, again, his phone number is 231-935-4217.
Thank you.
And anything else in the offing? Another book? Are you going to do one on the lighthouse, lifesavers? Or?
Well, that's Janice here is going to be the proofreader and the main helper on this. She helps me so much with the writing. I couldn't do this as smoothly without her help. And yes, there will be a book on the life-saving station. Hopefully it'll be out next year. And that's going to be as big a book, about 400 pages. This book has 400 pictures. The other one will probably have a lot of rare pictures I got from Washington and private individuals. It's going to be a nice look at the life-saving station.
Well, these people were in a dangerous situation. I'm sure they kept records of them, you know, for posterity.
Yes.
Well, thanks for being with us today. Probably could have talked for another hour on all the things going on there, but... Again, you have the book, A Comprehensive History, written by a native son, The Point of Barks Lighthouse, and it's Captain Ron Burkhardt. And we've also had in the studio today Janice Stein. She's also an author. She did a book on some of the small one-room schoolhouses in the area, and I'm sure that's a never-ending story because there's a whole bunch of them that can keep on going. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news. Just keep it here at WLEW.